WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thomas Barnett was once a backroom Defense Department analyst, but now he's got the ear of Donald Rumsfeld and top brass at the Pentagon. His grand strategy could radically transform the United States military into a full-time global force of warriors and nation-builders. A tall order, but one that's already being put into play in Iraq. Tonight on Point, Thomas Barnett and the Pentagon's new map of the world. We turn first to Iraq, where over 100 people, including three American soldiers, were killed today in a wave of terror attacks in six cities across the country. Earlier I spoke to Matthew McAllister, Middle East correspondent for Newsday in Baghdad. I asked him to describe the attacks that claimed so many lives today.
What's different about these attacks today is the level of coordination and sophistication involved. I mean, we really haven't seen early morning coordinated attacks in five or six different cities at the same time with the same kind of attacks, car bombings, and for the first time sort of waves of almost infantry-like attacks on Iraqi police stations. And what was different about today is that in at least one or two of them, they were black-clad figures claiming loyalty to Abu Musab Zarqawi, the Jordanian militant whom American forces claim is leading much of the insurgency against Iraqi and American forces. And that's the first time, really, that this hitherto underground organizations appeared, you know, in the streets. And it surprised a lot of people.
And there's no doubt in people's minds that this escalation of attacks is intended to disrupt the June 30th handover.
No, I mean, I think it's clear. And in fact, the statement put out on an Islamist website this evening by a group connected to Zarqawi or claimed to be connected to Zarqawi makes that explicit. And there are 6 days left until the handover. American commanders have been predicting this. And these predictions really are coming true. And the coming days could well see more similar attacks. And in the morning, we'll see what comes.
And despite the brazen nature of these attacks and the large number of fatalities, the interim Prime Minister Ayad Alawi is playing them down.
He is. He's saying that it's primarily former regime officials, and I think that's being a little bit optimistic. I mean, it's in his interest to say that this is just the dying embers of a past regime rather than something that could almost appear to be on the verge of being an uprising rather than an insurgency. And, of course, a popular uprising would be an absolute disaster for coalition forces and the interim Iraqi government, which hasn't even come into power and is already having, you know, broad, you know, five or six cities attacks on its police officers.
You mentioned the Jordanian militant Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who the United States links to al-Qaeda. In fact, U.S. forces in Iraq have been going after him, haven't they, in recent days?
They have. In spite of the truce reached in Fallujah, the town about 40 miles west of Baghdad, in recent days, including today, there have been airstrikes on what the United States military says are safe houses for militants linked with Zarqawi. And, of course, that has the impact of sort of inflaming passions in a place that was calming down to some extent, over which the United States has absolutely no military control at the moment, but which is also a source of suicide bombers apparently coming into places like Baghdad and causing such havoc.
Are U.S. forces visibly increasing security in the run-up to the June 30th handover?
Not that I've seen. There's no extra presence really on the streets of Baghdad. I haven't traveled outside of Baghdad in recent days. It's just a little too dangerous, frankly, for foreigners to go out. And so the presence is pretty low-key. In the outskirts, though, what the targets have become are the sort of proxies for the Americans, and that's the Iraqi police stations, and that's what's being attacked. That's what was primarily attacked today. And the message to the Iraqi police and future recruits for the Iraqi police is, if you join the nascent police and army in Iraq, this is what will happen to you. And that, in a sense, is much more deleterious to the future of a stable Iraq than attacking soldiers who are from another country and eventually will leave.
So the militants now very specifically targeting those they describe as collaborators.
Yeah, and it's putting the fear of God. I was speaking with, into all sorts of people, I was speaking with a head teacher at a high school for girls in Baghdad yesterday, and I said, have you been threatened? And unusually, she said she hadn't, and she said, but as soon as I do, I'm quitting, and I'm going back home. And, you know, it would be a catastrophe. It was a high school for intellectually advanced kids. And it would be a catastrophe for them. And it's happening all over the place, intellectuals, doctors being targeted and killed. And it's undermining, it's eating away at the core of Iraqi society.
So if these kinds of attacks are happening in the run-up to the handover, what about the day itself? There must be a certain apprehension about what could happen.
I think there is, and I think it's actually a little ironic because I've spent the last few days wandering around Baghdad asking all sorts of people, from police officers to teachers to doctors, what's going to be the difference between June the 30th and July the 1st? And the answer overwhelmingly is either nothing or I don't know. It's not like things are going to change very much here. The American military is still going to be based in Iraqi police stations. They're still going to be in their bases. Some very familiar faces are going to be occupying the ministries. And so it's a lot of people are very skeptical about whether this handover means anything and whether it is, in fact, more to do with domestic American politics and global politics than it is to do with Iraqis regaining control over their country.
So no expectation, certainly among Iraqis, that there'll be a decrease in the level of violence after June 30th?
No, quite the opposite. I was in an emergency room yesterday and was interviewing a police officer who had just been shot in the thigh by a kidnapper, and he was very much of the opinion that it's only going to get worse. I mean, look, if the largest military force in the history of the world can't control the country, then a fledgling indigenous security force that, you know, doesn't have enough men and weapons and training, you know, certainly isn't going to be able to do it.
Matthew McAllister, many thanks.
Thank you.
Matthew McAllister is Middle East correspondent for Newsday. He spoke to us from Baghdad. During the Cold War, the Pentagon's strategic map of the world divided east from west. Since the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Pentagon has been in search of a new grand strategy. The war on terror has provided an immediate focus, but Thomas Barnett, Naval War College professor and Defense Department analyst, has an even bigger, bolder vision for the future of America's military, and key players at the highest levels in the Pentagon are listening. Barnett's world is in two main parts, what he calls the functioning core versus the non-integrating gap. The core consists of modern industrial, highly developed states. In the gap are failed, failing, and repressive states. Modern war and conflict, Barnett says, come from the gap, and shrinking that gap should be the Pentagon's most important function. In order to do that, Barnett proposes a military that's a far cry from today's armed forces. Their primary weapon will be globalization. There are shades of his plan already in action in Iraq, but will it work? Tonight on Point, the Pentagon's new map, warriors, nation builders, and a provocative new strategy for the United States military. Is the United States military in need of a radical overhaul? Is transforming the American armed forces into a worldwide globalization force the way to do it? And would it help or hinder the war on terror? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Providence, Rhode Island, is Thomas Barnett, senior strategic researcher and professor at the U.S. Naval War College from 2001 to 2003. He was assistant for strategic futures in the Office of Force Transformation in the Pentagon. His new book is The Pentagon's New Map, War and Peace in the 21st Century. Thomas Barnett, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And with us also from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Julian, and hello, Mr. Barnett.
Thomas Barnett, what's the thinking, very broadly, behind your strategic plan?
Well, the whole concept of the map really began with a simple plotting out of where we've sent military forces since the end of the Cold War. If you remember back to the Cold War, where we went was largely in response to where the Soviets went and where we saw correlations of power slipping to our disadvantage. So we engaged in proxy wars and we had client states, just like the Soviets did. And that basically determined where we went around what we used to call the Third World. The Soviets go away at the end of the Cold War, and there's really nobody out there interested in what we used to call that third world. And so, in many ways, the places we sent forces since 1990 represent sort of the natural demand pattern for what I call the exporting of U.S. security, meaning the time and attention our troops spend on any region's potential or actual incidences of mass violence. And this concept of the non-integrating gap began with just plotting the almost 150 places, almost 150 events we've engaged in, not including the humanitarian and disaster relief. So incidences where there was some chance of warfare erupting. And all we did was basically draw a circle around those areas and asked what unites those regions of the world. And there are a lot of things that unite those regions of the world in terms of what they lack, in terms of lower levels of development. But the key thing that I focused on in the book and in the research and in the vision is really that these regions represent those parts of the world that are least connected to the globalized economy. And in fact, even the concept of globalization is sort of a misnomer, because in many ways the global economy doesn't extend everywhere on this planet. It is deeply connective in terms of the interactions and the alliances and the transaction rates of economic trade. It deeply connects major regions of the world, but there's about one-third of humanity, this non-integrating gap that stretches basically from the Caribbean Rim, the Andes portion of South America, most of Africa, the Caucasus, the Balkans, the Middle East, and much of Southeast Asia.
Would it be true to say that what you envisage for the U.S. military is really being an arm of U.S. economic policy rather than foreign policy?
Well, during the Cold War, I think the argument was that you had such a threat in terms of global nuclear Armageddon that military matters kind of sat at the top position of our agenda with the outside world. It was the thing we had to worry about the most. It was the thing, the prism through which we viewed our relationships around the world. When global nuclear Armageddon comes off the table, then it's natural, I would argue, for the military and the employment of military power to be subjugated to larger goals. And I don't think it's a matter of distinguishing between U.S. foreign policy versus U.S. economic policy. I think they're very much of the same focus, and that is growing the global economy and reconnecting or connecting for the first time those parts of the world that are poorly connected to the global economy, because that's where you find all the wars. That's where you find all the civil wars, the genocide, the ethnic cleansing, the incidences of mass rape as a tool of terror, virtually all the terrorist groups we care about, virtually all the drug producers, all the situations where children are forced into combat. All the mass violence in the world is found in these regions that are least connected. So it's not a matter of paving the way for U.S. corporations. It's a matter of extending the stability that allows the global economy to come into these regions and to provide the masses there the economic opportunity that brings stability and peace.
The briefest of reactions from you, Jack, to this redrawing of the map of the world.
Well, this grand strategy strikes me as a recipe for endless, pointless, needless war, not for democracy, but commerce. It's diagnostically dubious, strategically counterproductive, programmatically incoherent, and politically impossible. And we don't have time to go through all of those, but let's just stay with the diagnosis. I mean, Mr. Barnett treats globalization as the cure. Well, of course, what we saw, I mean, the terrorists who struck us didn't come from an unglobalized place, Afghanistan. They came from Saudi Arabia, where in Riyadh, in the mall, you can't throw a rock without hitting a Victoria's Secrets place. And they came from Cairo, where Kentucky Fried Chicken is everywhere. And they came from sophisticated, worldly, Western, modernized, globalized Lebanon. And one of the arguments, of course, is it's precisely globalization, Westernization, that has brought about this Muslim fundamentalist revolution.
Jack Beattie, we're going to have to leave it there for a moment. We're talking tonight about the Pentagon's new map with Naval War College Professor Thomas Barnett and On Point's Jack Beattie. What do you make of Thomas Barnett's grand strategy? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a provocative new plan to restructure the United States military with Naval War College professor Thomas Barnett. From 2001 to 2003, he served as assistant for strategic futures in the Pentagon Office of Force Transformation. His new book is The Pentagon's New Map, War and Peace in the 21st Century. Also with us tonight, On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. Thomas Barnett says that with his new military strategy, the end of war is within our historical grasp. Do you agree? What's your point of his map of core and gap countries? Is globalization in this post-9/11 world the best way to shrink the gap? And should America's military be the primary force for his grand strategic transformation? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Thomas Barnett, before the break, you heard Jack Beattie tearing into your new strategic plan. What's your reaction?
Well, my reaction is Jack's obviously hasn't read the book because he'd have a better grasp of the data. The Middle East is not well connected. It is not well globalized. It has the lowest level of interregional trade in the world, even lower than sub-Saharan Africa. 20 years ago, the Middle East represented roughly 10% of world trade. Today, it represents roughly 3% of world trade, and almost all of that is energy. 20 years ago, it attracted roughly 5% of foreign direct investment from the global economy. Today, it attracts a little over 1.5%. 8 of the 11 economies in the region do not belong to the World Trade Organization. The notion that the Middle East is globalized simply because they send out oil, take in money, and rich elites there live Victorian secret lifestyles, I think is nonsense. I think Jack's grasp of where the global economy is and where it isn't is pretty distorted.
Okay, let's just, Jack, before I bring you back in, let me just get Thomas Barnett to explain in a little more detail his notion of creating two distinct U.S. military forces to push through this plan. Tell me more.
Well, it's described by a lot of people as a radical concept. Actually, all it does is return us back to the reality we had prior to the Second World War. Throughout most of our history, we have had a Department of War, a big military force that we would mount whenever we felt we needed to engage in war. And then we had a Department of Everything Else, which historically was known as the Department of Navy. That was our networking force that went out and interacted with the outside world, maintained our economic connectivity with that outside world, and when trouble erupted across the system, that was the force we sent out, the Navy and the Marines, to deal with it. All I'm talking about is resurrecting that bifurcated force. We put those two departments together in 1947 because we felt, I would argue correctly, that we were going to be involved in a long-term hair-trigger standoff with the Soviet Union. And so we fused the concepts of national defense and international security. We no longer face that threat. My argument is we have the world's preeminent warfighting force, or what I call the Leviathan force, the U.S. military. We can't find any other militaries willing to even take us on. There's no question that there's no regime that we can't take down across this gap. What we don't have is a second half force to come in and do the peacekeeping and the nation building that must follow. So we're really a first half team in a league that insists on keeping score until the end of the game, until we build that back half force, which we have in embryonic form, but not nearly prioritized enough. A good example, we have 100,000 Humvees in the U.S. Army arsenal. Only 2% of them currently are armored. So we're desperately short of armored Humvees for our operations in the peacekeeping phase of this occupation in Iraq for the last year. That's a result of favoring and focusing on that Leviathan force, as I describe it, that warfighting force, for the last 10 years. We've been basically buying one military, but increasingly operating another sort, and that is that peacekeeping force, which we need to really invest in. And if we don't invest in, we won't attract the coalition forces from around the world, which frankly aren't built for the warfighting force capabilities that we possess and can't fight alongside us really effectively anymore, but are very eager and very willing to engage us on that peacekeeping side of the ledger because that's really what they're capable of.
Jack Beattie, you can hardly take issue with that.
No, certainly. That, on those tactical matters, that certainly makes sense. But let's get back to the big picture. this idea of intervening in these small countries to hook them up to the global economy is strategically counterproductive. I mean, don't take my word for it. Take the word of the CIA anti-terrorism expert Anonymous, who's just written a book saying Iraq is a boomerang war. We're creating more terrorists than we're killing. We're doing it through the media of international communications. This would follow us wherever we intervened, and it would be repeated endlessly so that we'd have a cycle of enemies constantly being produced by the very thing we're supposed to be doing to end them, to stop them. It's programmatically incoherent because he calls basically for giving up on the European allies, by whom we're tied, by history, tradition, interest, values, and having a new alliances with China, Russia, and India. Well, look at the striking things about those countries. They all have problems with Muslim either minorities, or in the case of India, they're looking across a border at a hair trigger nuclear armed Muslim state, and the last thing in the world they want to do is to be joining us to invade mostly Muslim countries in Africa to hook them up to globalization. As for Russia with the Chechens, do you think they want to go around the world doing this? And finally, politically impossible abroad. Other people do not want to be tutored into the modern age. They're going to stumble their way in. And you know, if you put this to the electorate, you get a resounding 35% of it, which is good, millions of people, except that the other guy would win in a landslide. The people would not support this. Already by 54 to 40%, they think Iraq was a mistake. Okay. And Iraq, remember, wasn't about commerce or globalization. It was about all our ideals, democracy, which Mr. Barnett just says, oh, well, that stuff, you can't really afford that in a world with these terrorists.
Okay, let's just bring back Thomas Barnett, and let me put it to him that U.S. history is already littered with the ill effects, the blowback of such relationships of convenience, which you're proposing in the future.
I think you have to distinguish between the relationships of convenience that we engaged in during the Cold War and what we're going to try to seek to achieve across this post-Cold War era, when there's not really anybody on the other side who can really act as a patron for those forces we may engage in a global war on terror. So I don't think we need to think in terms of dealing with bad actors so much as we need to think in terms of dealing with those dictators and dealing with those would-be dictators in the form of terrorists, whose main goal is to take power in governments and create great disconnectedness between their populations and the outside world, thus allowing them to maintain control over those people.
What role does democratization play in your vision?
Democratization is not a means, it's an end. My argument with why we need to be engaged in the Middle East is a fairly straightforward one. If you're worried about global terrorism, there's three ways you can deal with it. You can put a firewall around America. You can try to shut us down from the outside and keep these bad guys from coming here. I think that's going to pervert our society. I think it's going to ruin our economy. You can try to chase these guys down around the world and kill them as fast as possible, which is basically what Israel's been trying to do for the last several decades. I think you create more terrorists that way than you actually eliminate. The third way is to think strategically about what their goals are. And their goals are fairly explicit. What bin Laden represents, what Zarqawi represents, is an attempt to hijack a major portion of humanity, those countries in the Middle East where they think they can institute some sort of fundamentalist authoritarian rule, and basically pull them, keep them out of a global economy, jerk them out of that stability that greater connectivity allows when globalization comes into a region. And if we want to really deal with what they're trying to achieve, then we have to get there faster than they do. We have to connect the Middle East faster than they can disconnect it.
Okay, let's take a call from Brian in New York City. Brian, what did you want to say?
Hi. Well, I just wanted to say that earlier in the year in my economics class, they brought the idea of opportunity cost, you know, having, you know, the cost of not going with your other option, right? And I always thought, you know, since then, about the connection between introducing a market economy into places where they don't really have much, like the idea of suicide bombers, for example, that I've always felt that one of their main motivations, I guess you could say, is that they don't really have much to lose. And I think that in introducing a market economy to some of these places that it would give them, you know, more of a, they'd be losing more and giving up their lives, whereas now they sort of feel like...
So you agree, Brian, do you, with Thomas Barnett?
Yes, completely.
Thomas Barnett, in the Brave New World, if I can phrase it like that, that you envisage, how would you close the gap between the core and the gap?
The gap gets shrunk primarily through private sector resource flows. What is integrated, half the world's population, are those 24 new globalizers, as the World Bank likes to call them, which include an India and a China and a Brazil and countries of that nature. What has integrated them over the last 20 years has fundamentally been foreign direct investment. That's long-term investment that goes into a country and takes equity ownership or creates new businesses. That's what essentially shrinks the gap. Now, that money doesn't go where it doesn't feel welcome, where there aren't rules in place that allow businessmen to feel comfortable about putting their money there long-term, and it sure doesn't go into war zones. So the role of the military in shrinking the gap is basically dealing with those incidences of mass violence around the world, and you pick and choose, and you prioritize them in terms of the dangers you think they represent, the costs of life that are being incurred, and the potential for success. What the military does is goes in and takes out those bad actors that are creating the violence and keeping those regions disconnected from the global economy. And the effort at that point becomes one of reconnecting that society to the outside world, which involves, I think, a major nation-building and peacekeeping effort that will keep the military there for a stretch of time, but over time segues into the roles of the private voluntary organizations, the non-governmental organizations, the traditional official developmental aid that comes from the West, and then over time you see the foreign direct investment come in. Because foreign direct investment and business in what I describe as the core is always looking for stable situations where there is cheap labor to utilize.
Won't your plan, though, simply lead to many more Iraqs around the world, a situation of perpetual war even?
Yeah, you get that argument a lot. First, we're talking about two-thirds of humanity where there is no mass violence. So it's not a worldwide concept, and we're not going to play a global cop. If two-thirds of the world gets along just fine without any application of U.S. military power, we have to be clear, we're only talking about one-third. When you look at that one-third, it's roughly 100 countries. In any situation, calculation of where there's mass violence, what you find is that there's usually one-third of the countries there, or about 2 to 3 dozen, that at any one time are experiencing mass violence. Our tendency is to get involved with roughly about one quarter of those at any one time. So we're talking about 8 to 10 situations that we're involved with simultaneously around the world at various levels of degree. Obviously, right now, everybody's focused on in Iraq, but we have situations that we're dealing with elsewhere in the world at much less levels of manpower. And we've been doing that steadily for the last 15 years.
Let's take another call from Michael in New York City. Michael?
Hello, Mr. Barnett. Your idea of two forces, it seems really interesting, but it seems like peacekeeping, peacemaking, and nation-building isn't just a job for soldiers.
Absolutely.
What degree do you see a role for the integration of non-military actors like the State Department and USAID in this new nation-building force that you're envisioning?
Excellent question. I see a tremendous role for that. In fact, I see the force that we put together that I describe as the system administrator force, the one that's focused on the second half or the peacekeeping and the nation building, being simultaneously a core group of military, but increasingly over time involving not just U.S. Agency for International Development people, but I think you see Coast Guards involved. You see all sorts of federal agencies that have to do with developmental aid going overseas and encouraging investment and telecommunications connectivity. I think it's going to have a tremendous private sector quality to it, because I think it has to be a force that is not just bureaucratically multilingual, able to talk across all the agencies, but it has to be increasingly a force that can deal effectively with private sector involvement.
Jack Beatty, could I bring you in again and ask you, having heard Thomas Barnett expand a little bit more on his future vision, whether you're any more convinced?
I'm not really. I don't really see U.S. military power as in any way an instrument of the modernization of the world. I think First of all, one of the good things, the only good thing about this tragic intervention in Iraq is that it really pretty much dooms this sort of ambitious globalism, or, pardon me, one-third of the worldism, because the American public wants no part of it. Countries, you only have the right to send your young men and women into combat if your vital interests are at stake. And, of course, we knew that in Iraq they weren't. And, you know, that is the, morally, that's the only reason you can look at a parent and say, your son has got to go in harm's way. You can't be sending forces around the world promiscuously to topple governments and bring in administrators and connect them to the world economy just because it would be a great idea, or just because in some long-term vision it would end terrorism. There are more efficient ways of going about that, and ways that wouldn't have the American electorate clamoring for your impeachment.
Thomas Barnett, in fact, you envisage this Leviathan force as being made up of highly trained soldiers who, in your own words, are young, unmarried, and slightly pissed off.
Well, my point with that is the Leviathan force basically, as I like to describe it, is your dad's military. It's very much the force that was rebuilt after Vietnam. And when I talk about separating out those aspects that can be devoted and need to be given more prioritization and more investment for that nation-building peacekeeping role, I'm not talking about messing with that core warfighting capability, which I think we still want, because I think there are bad actors around the world that we need to deal with.
But this Leviathan force, as described by you, sounds like a group of men who might be prepared to die.
Well, any military that engages in combat activity, there's always the expectation of death. So I'm not sure what your point is on that one. It's the military that we've known and had for the last 50, 60 years. I'm not talking about changing that force. In fact, it's the transformation of that force, the modernization of that force, which allows it to get smaller and smaller and therefore frees up the resources within a defense department to build this other force over time. So I'm not talking about a bigger military in terms of numbers. I'm not talking about a more expensive military over time. I'm talking about doing both these forces basically with the resources we have at hand. And in fact, we have both these forces. We just don't admit it, and we don't shift the resources from the warfighting side to the peacekeeping side in enough of a manner so that we can field a force in Iraq since May 2003 that can really do the job it needs to do.
Stay with us, Thomas Barnett, and you too, Jack Beattie. Does Thomas Barnett's plan for a two-pronged military sound plausible to you? Does a Leviathan force and systems operator force in the Pentagon sound like the path to peace or to perpetual war? Is this the way you want the Pentagon's new map to be drawn? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a provocative new plan to restructure the United States military with Naval War College professor Thomas Barnett. From 2001 to 2003, he served as assistant for strategic futures in the Pentagon Office of Force Transformation. His new book is The Pentagon's New Map, War and Peace in the 21st Century. Also with us tonight, On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. What do you make of Thomas Barnett's two-pronged mission for the military should the U.S. scrap its traditional European alliances in favor of new ties with China, India, and Russia, as Barnett suggests? Does the Pentagon have the manpower, money, and political backing to deploy a Leviathan and systems operator force, or is the military already overstretched? And if military nation-building is already so difficult in Iraq, can the Pentagon take on the same task around the world? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Thomas Barnett, if Iraq is the testbed for your future vision, albeit embryonically, it doesn't augur well for the future, it might be argued.
Yeah, two things I want to deal with first. This concept of perpetual war you guys keep tossing out. I really have a problem with you constantly throwing that up in the air. Because
just asking again, it as a question, Mr.
I've emphasized
Barnett.
many times that we're talking about at any one point in history, roughly 5% of the world in terms of the countries and in terms of the populations involved in the sort of mass violence that we're describing. So to portray that as a worldwide situation and to portray that as perpetual war is, I think, complete nonsense. You can keep tossing it out to your listeners because it sounds good, but I think it's complete nonsense. The second point I'd like to make, because I don't get the feeling either you guys read the book and are relying on criticisms, I have never said we scrap the alliance with Europe. All I've described is that we need to think beyond traditional relationships and involve those countries who have joined the global economy over the last 20 years and who are incentivized to care about what happens in the Middle East. Developing Asia's energy requirements are doubling over the next 20 years. They're going to get the vast majority of that energy out of the Middle East. So there are very good reasons, very realistic reasons, and I know this because I talked to the Chinese military and I talked to the Indian military, that they are incredibly interested at what goes down in the Middle East. Now to your question. The situation in Iraq, I think, demonstrates that, again, we don't have that second-half force. We have prioritized the warfighting aspect of our military. We've gotten it to such a degree that when we go into an Iraq, the military there won't even fight us. They basically disappear into the woodwork. The strategic errors we made were to underestimate the difficulty of the second half, the peacekeeping effort, and to not spend the time explaining ourselves adequately to allies, in effect telling them, if you aren't going to show up for the war, don't show up for the peace and forget about any sort of contracts in the nation building that's going to follow, that alienated some key players that we need to get in there. What we have right now are basically the oldest allies that we know from the Cold War willing to come into the Middle East. What we have not done is made the deals with those new players who are incredibly interested in the Middle East, like a China and an India. We asked India for 17,000 peacekeepers several months ago. They came close to giving it to us, but they basically said, you know what, we don't think you have the capabilities to really pull this off, and we're not going to let you use our troops as fodder. Okay. That shows that the decisions we've made in terms of investment over the last 10 years has not yielded that second-half force, and until we build that second-half force, we're not going to get real victories in this global war on terrorism.
Okay. I never actually stated categorically that you were suggesting or the scenario that you were putting forward actually envisaged perpetual war. I just simply asked aloud how it differed from the concept of perpetual war. But let's take a call from Brandon in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. What did you want to ask?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that this guy sounds like he just sounds like a total psychopath. And, let's look at a couple of things he said. First of all, one-third isn't really a big portion of the world. Well, one-third is one-third. I mean, like, one-third, I'm misunderstanding fractions. That's a lot. That's big. And let's also look at what he said about, what we need is a group of unmarried, really pissed-off guys. Well, that sounds a lot like some Muslim fundamentalists who blew up the Trade Center 3 years ago, doesn't it? Okay, so let's make a little force of psychopaths to advance this totally whacked out agenda.
Okay, let me just ask for a response to that rather impassioned question there from Thomas Barnett. And if you could just keep your answer quite brief, Mr. Barnett, because we've got a lot of other callers on the line.
Yeah, in terms of one-third of humanity, I think you have to remember that what the global economy was prior to 1980 was basically one-tenth of humanity. It was basically Western Europe, Japan, and the United States. What we've seen in the last 20 years is roughly half of humanity come online in the global economy. And we've seen an absolute reduction in the number of poor around the world. The number of people living on less than a dollar a day was 1.5 billion 20 years ago. It's 1.1 billion today. That was 40% of humanity 20 years ago. It's 20% today. So I think you have to describe globalization and its spread as not just a progress in terms of extending the reach of multinationals from the United States. You have to talk about the hundreds of millions of people that have been lifted out of abject poverty around the world. In terms of the young man and that moniker, that's simply a description that says what that warfighting force has to be populated with tends to be very young people.
Mr. Barnett, let me just I did ask you to be quite brief. You've got another caller, John from Green Bay, Wisconsin. John?
Yes, hi. Mr. Barnett, I enjoyed your book very much. I did read it. I had a couple of concerns while I was reading it, though. One goes kind of to the core of your issue with disconnectedness. I do agree with that in general. However, I do feel that there are some serious other issues at work there besides just evil leaders that want to disconnect a part of a population. I think there are other kind of more powerful older forces, some of them, unfortunately, things like ethnic groups. And then also there's governments, foreign governments or otherwise, and corporations that do bear a share of the responsibility. That was one point. The other point was that I think in some ways I understand what you're talking about in terms of the Leviathan and a system administrator force. And, again, it's a good idea. But again, as far as the Leviathan goes, I think possibly you're selling America's allies short in some degree. Maybe they can't participate to the same level. That's true. However, I think that in other areas of the world, I think that they do have things to offer and they can play a larger role. So maybe America does bear a large part of the burden. It is a large part of the economy, but I don't think it should bear maybe to the same degree that you describe. And those are my two points, one in regard to disconnectedness and the other in regard to our allies and our interactions with them.
Thomas Barnett, could I just ask you again to be quite brief, because we do have a lot of other callers.
In terms of the disconnectedness, yeah, there are a lot of variables that factor into that. And I think the key thing to remember is as globalization comes into traditional societies, it does create tumult. It alters the relationships between men and women. It alters the role of women in society. It alters educational patterns. It does a lot of things to shake things up. So when it is encroaching in that Middle Eastern part of the world the last 10 or 15 years, it's no surprise that you're going to see a lot of people very upset with that. And some portion of that population find it so abhorrent that they're willing to die to keep it out. In terms of the Leviathan versus the sysadmin force, in terms of allies, I do contend that there's a basic reality that very few countries can really participate in war fighting with us. That's something we've known and tried to deal with over the last 15 years. My point is, with the sysadmin force and the peacekeeping focus force, there you can really tap allies in a big, big way.
Mr. Barnett, can the United States afford to fund this plan? Will it not involve the military draft and tax increases?
No, again, it doesn't involve a bigger share of the federal budget, because we're talking about taking advantage of the successes we've had in transforming the warfighting aspect. So that part of the force gets smaller even as it gets more lethal. We can go into countries with less troops, less platforms involved. So it's the savings from the modernization of the warfighting force that gets you the resources freed up for the sysadmin part, for the peacekeeping and the nation-building force. In terms of more people, no. We need fewer people to wage war as we progress in terms of this transformation. There are the numbers inside the Defense Department now to sufficiently seed that peacekeeping force, and until we seed it, we won't be able to tap allies in a big, big way, because most allies around the world, they don't have the warfighting capability. They don't have the ships and the aircraft to actually participate with us. What they do have are lots of bodies. So it's that pool of resources, that labor that we need to be able to tap into. But until we show we're serious about it, they won't join, because they have to see a winning hand.
Jack Beatty, do the numbers in Thomas Barnett's new plan add up to you?
No. But other numbers do. You know, if we wanted to really help these poor countries, tomorrow we could stop our agriculture subsidies. We could stop subsidizing 25,000 cotton farmers who effectively are putting the economy of Mali out of business. The Europeans could stop their $300 billion a year subsidies. And we could finally allow these countries to produce and export what they can do, which is agricultural products that are labor intensive. We have a globalization going.
Chapter 7 in my book. You can read it all. So, again.
Well, good. But that's a better investment, a better way to spend our money than to, you know, the great thing about globalization is it's change without force. Just let economics change. For heaven's sakes, we're not invading China, and yet we recognize that every day China is changing because of the soft power of globalization.
Right.
Let
there were no Chinese in the aircraft that took down the World Trade Center. The reason why we're involved in the Middle East is because when globalization comes into that Middle East, there are forces there so willing to keep it out, to drive Westerners out, and to keep that part of the world as disconnected as possible from the outside, that they're going to fight us. And they're going to fight us whether we're there or not.
Thomas Barnett, who's listening inside the Pentagon to your brief on transforming the military? Do you have the ears of those right at the top, namely Donald Rumsfeld himself?
When I was in the position, what I did was I briefed superiors who had the opportunity to brief Secretary Rumsfeld and others. I spent a lot of my time working with the captains and the colonels throughout the military. And my focus on those individuals are as follows. That's the crew that's going to be running this military 10 years from now, because it's a very much up and out, up or out sort of management style in the military. So I try to focus on the next generation of leaders, realizing that they're the ones most incentivized to think about the reality of the vision that I think I'm putting forward.
Let's take a quick call from Phil in the Bronx, New York. Phil?
Yes, gentlemen, war doesn't seem to have gotten American foreign policy and American respect in various foreign lands much over the past decades. Eisenhower went to Korea and ended the Korean War, and then he warned against the military-industrial complex, which this Iraqi war is all about, because our real enemy is the enemy that produces now nuclear possibilities for the Muslim world, which is Iran, and there's another one in the Far East called Korea, who is not only supplying, not only possibly supplying nuclear material, ballistic missiles.
Okay, well, let's bring Thomas Barnett back. And I think in your vision, you do plan to take the North Korean leader out of the equation. Is that right?
I think what we have to focus on in North Korea is regime change as quickly as we can gain in a sense of understanding from the major players in the region that Kim Jong-il is not only somebody who's responsible for killing literally 3 to 4 million, we estimate, of his own people, but that he represents a serious threat to the region as a whole. He's a major drug exporter. He's a major exporter of counterfeit currencies, which creates significant problems for a China as it increasingly opens up to the outside world. But we can't do anything with a Kim Jong-il until we get a China, a South Korea, a Japan, even a Russia on board. What would come out of that takedown, which I would argue wouldn't necessarily have to involve military invasion whatsoever, if we got enough of the players in the region basically to say to Kim Jong-il, you're going to have to step out of power, I think we could engineer it quite peacefully once he realizes he has no options. But what we'd get out of that victory, I would argue, is probably the seeds of a NATO-like military alliance in East Asia, which would cement the United States and China in terms of their strategic relationship for the long term and create a much better situation there.
Okay, many thanks to you, Thomas Barnett. I've been speaking to Naval War College Professor Thomas Barnett from 2001 to 2003. He served as Assistant for Strategic Futures in the Pentagon Office of Force Transformation. His new book is The Pentagon's New Map, War and Peace in the 21st Century. Also with us tonight, On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. Continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Jane Manners, Tamar Morad, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth and Cora Peterson. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.